Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent. I'm the Reverend Renee Rohutsky. I am a community minister that's affiliated with this congregation. I actually work for our national office in Boston, although I'm a field staff person, so I live here in Kent. Our chalice lighting is from Albert Schweitzer. At times, our own light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another person. Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us.
My grandpa passed away right before my high school graduation. After he died, my grandma gave me three things that he never left the house without: his watch, his prayer book, and his cap. You see, Grandpa was one of the most important people in my life. He was my father figure, and he was also my best friend. Spending time with him was greater than anything in the whole world. And he cared deeply for others and wanted to help whenever he could. His heart was as big as his reputation. And as my aunt often recalls, Frank Chekai was a legend. I feel so privileged as a worship associate to share with you a bit about him today. One thing everyone remembers is how enormous his hands were. I remember in high school helping him off the couch, and even then, my fairly large hands would be completely engulfed by his. His embrace was just as colossal. A big barrel chest and strong arms could crush the life out of you, and yet make you feel so comfortable at the exact same time. He had a very boisterous laugh, and he wasn't shy about it. He loved my grandma's chocolate chip cookies, so much so that grandma had to hide them from him, and he would constantly ask me to get him some because I knew where they were. And ice cream. It would be expected that if my grandpa sat down with a gallon of ice cream, he'd probably polish it off within the hour. Most importantly, grandpa loved spending time with me. Throwing the football, going to Woolworths for lunch, comforting me when I couldn't sleep. Heck, we even came up with this scheme for me to learn Polish so that we could talk in code and Grandma wouldn't know our secrets. Now every morning when I wake up, his watch sits next to mine, reminding me of our time together. His prayer book stays in our car, protecting us in our travels. And his cap resides atop the bookshelf that contains my college studies, as if to remind me that he is proud. So while I no longer get to see him light up a room with his physical presence, his spirit remains very much alive in these items and in my heart. Come, let us worship together. Soul Food by Janice Mirakitani. We prepare the meal together. I complain, hurt, reduced to fury again by their insults, sinuations, because I am married to you. Impossible autonomy, no mind of my own. You like your fish crisp, coated with cornmeal, fried deep, sliced mangoes to sweeten the tang of lemons. My fish is raw, on shredded lettuce, lemon slices thin as skin, wasabi burning like green fire. You bake the cornbread flat and dip it in the thick soup that I have brewed from turkey carcass, rice gruel, sesame seed oil, and chervil. We laugh over watermelon and bubbling cobbler. You say there are few men who can stand to have a woman equal, upright. This meal, unsurpassed.
Spirit of life and love, Spirit of wholeness and brokenness, Spirit who is with us always, in joy, in sorrow, in celebration, in struggle. Help us to remember that we are not alone. There is beauty. There is tenderness. There is love. Help us to keep our connections to one another, to the greater whole, to the love which binds us all. Amen, and blessed be.
Auction, as retold by Margaret Sliff. There once was an old man who owned a priceless art collection, including a number of old masterpieces that was the envy of many art connoisseurs. The same man also had a much beloved son, and they often used to enjoy their art collection together. However, war broke out and the son was called up and went off to fight. One day, the telegram arrived informing the father that his son had been killed in action. The old man was devastated. He grieved silently, alone, and unremittingly. A few months went by, and there was a knock at the door. A young man stood there with a small package under his arm. "You don't know me," he introduced, "but I knew your son very well. We were in the same unit, and I was with him the day he was killed. I am the soldier that he gave his life for. He saved many lives that day, and carrying me to safety was when the bullet struck him. We'd become very close friends, and before he died, I drew this little picture of him. Now, I'm not a great artist, but I want you to have this sketch now." The father was silent for a long time, gazing into the eyes of his son, looking up from the soldier's sketch, his own eyes filling with tears as he gazed. He thanked the soldier and offered to pay for the sketch. "Oh, no, sir, it's a gift. I can never repay what your son did for me, and this sketch is all I have to give." The father hung the portrait above the mantelpiece for everyone to see. He treasured it far more than his other paintings put together, and he showed visitors the portrait of his son before he took them to visit any of his other paintings. Not long after this incident, the father himself passed away, and his art collection was put up for auction. Art collectors from all over the world gathered with the possibility of receiving one of these treasures. The auctioneer began the bidding, The first picture to come up for auction was the unknown soldier's sketch of the father's son. The auctioneer tried to start the bidding. "What is the bid for the first picture in this collection?" he asked. There was silence. Then there were rumblings and grumblings. "Come on," the art collector said. "Get on with the real stuff. No one's interested in that old sketch. We've come for the valuable pieces. Why don't you just get on with the sale?" But the auctioneer was having none of it. "I'm sorry," he said. "My instructions are clear. The deceased insists that the first item for up for sale is the picture of his son. Now, who will start me off the bidding at 10 pounds for the son?" "Sold," to the man in the back, "for 10 pounds. There was relief all around. Now the buyers could finally get their hands on those valuable pieces. But the auctioneer laid down his gavel. "The auction is over," he declared. "My instructions from the deceased are that whoever takes the son receives the entire estate, including the art collection. The man in the back gets the whole thing for 10 pounds.
This morning, I invite you to join me in one of my spiritual practices. I often take time to reflect on my values and habits. I try to discern where they came from. Some might be heirlooms that I treasure as part of my identity, connected to a long line of ancestors. Others might be curiosities, family qualities that influence the way I live in the world, whether I'm aware of it or not. And sometimes I need to make choices about which ones I need to cast off in order to grow as a person. Heirlooms. My father and my grandparents were refugees from Latvia during World War II. They escaped during the Russian invasion with only what they could carry. They first traveled by horse-drawn wagon. When the horse collapsed, the wagon was pulled by my burly grandfather. They made it to the coast and traveled by ship across the Baltic Sea to Germany. When they arrived, they were first sent to Auschwitz and then were redirected to a labor camp where they lived until the end of the war. At the end of the war, thanks to a sponsor who had a job waiting for my grandfather, they made their way to the United States and rebuilt their lives into a new semblance of stability. They did their best to recreate a little bubble of Latvian culture in their home, with textiles and pottery from the old country. My grandmother would only make traditional Latvian foods. Her house had a distinctive smell of sourdough, cabbage, dill, caraway, and pork cooking in its various forms. Their Catholic parish also had a northeast European character, with masses said in the native language and with rituals imported from the old country that were not part of my suburban congregation's programs. There was something about being connected to this little bubble of strange culture in the rest of our suburban middle-class lives that were dominated by white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, or WASPs. I knew that I didn't identify as a WASP, so I didn't really belong in the dominant culture. But I did have this other culture that was rich and tangible, and that helped me to form an identity outside of the local mainstream. There's someone that is part of my core that is still part of that Latvian heritage. Last winter, I co-hosted a service auction dinner with Marianne Casper, where we prepared and served selections that included my grandmother's recipes, foods that I hadn't tasted in decades. I set the table with pottery and textiles that were from her home. For a little bit of time, I reconnected to that part of my identity. And yet, it was clear that no one else in my family was having the same experience. My husband doesn't eat pork as a rule and found most of the recipes less than appetizing. My children had never tried most of the foods and had never developed a taste for them. The pottery and textiles were just more of my stuff that doesn't have any memories or meaning for my kids. A recent article in the Chicago Tribune talked about how there are generational differences when it comes to family heirlooms. A couple of generations ago, families had only a few treasures that they passed on, along with stories behind the things. Baby boomers have tended to feel a connection to those things in their stories, and when their older relatives pass on, they incorporate their heirlooms into their own homes, alongside the items that they themselves have collected, much as I have. But there is a disconnect between the items, the stories, and the next generation. Unless an item has a practical use or holds a new memory, it's likely that it'll end up in an estate sale once the current owner is gone. It's not the potential loss of the items themselves that I mourn. It's the sense of cultural identity embedded in the accompanying stories. I wonder what other ways we can use to pass on those stories if they're no longer connected to our stuff. Curiosities. We don't just inherit household items, such as dishes or furniture, from our families. We inherit our values. One family might value working with their hands, while another family might value education. One family might strive to be good to their neighbors, where another might make a point of going out and helping perfect strangers. We inherit our attitudes about things like sex, money, food, or the balance between work and play. Differences often play out in our committed relationships. One partner might be a saver and the other a bargain hunter. One might like to spend a day off watching television, where the other can only relax after all the household chores are done. What gets served at the Thanksgiving table? We inherit accents, mannerisms, figures of speech. We may inherit some things that are less than welcome, such as a tendency toward addiction or depression. In my work, I use family systems theory. Pioneered by Murray Bowen, this theory includes a few key concepts. One is that birth order makes a difference. The oldest child often becomes a leader. Middle children are often peacemakers. Another assumption is that patterns repeat in families. Yet another is that emotional fields in the family that influence how family members interact with one another. When someone begins to study their own family system, they can create a genogram, which is a special family tree that includes information such as close or cut-off relationships, addictions, chronic illnesses, or tragic deaths. And these genograms are used to look for patterns in families. If this interests you, I recommend a book called You Can Go Home Again, Reconnecting with Your Family by Monica McGoldrick. She creates genograms for famous families, such as the Kennedys, the Wright brothers, and Paul Robesons, as examples for you as you work out your own genograms. One of my favorites is her analysis of the family of John Quincy Adams, good Unitarians that were also an important part of our nation's history. It seems that the members of that family fell into two categories. One was a life of incredible success and influence. The other was a life of addiction or illness, resulting in catastrophic failure. The Adams saw themselves as a family as being above most of their peers and felt that their gifts were meant to be fully developed and then used in service of the greater good of the whole country. The amount of pressure they put on their children was to be perfect was incredible. When John Quincy was only 10, his mother admonished him, quote, "I had much rather you should have found your grave in the sea than to see you an immoral profligate or a graceless child." His father scolded, "You come into life with advantages which will disgrace you if your success is mediocre, and if you do not rise to the head of not only your profession, but of your country, it will be owing to your own laziness, slovenliness, and obstinacy." Though John Quincy Adams may have been a success by our standards, he never felt that he measured up to his parents' expectations, and his driven personality prevented a happy marriage. In contrast, his three siblings' lives turned out to be total disasters. Like with John Quincy Adams, the patterns of interaction that we establish with our families of origin are often mirrored in later patterns in our marriages, in our workplace, and even in our faith communities. This is where I invite your curiosity. We all have baggage, good, bad, and even mixed, like John Quincy, from our families of origin. I invite you to set aside judgment as you notice how you approach the world. Too often we feel shame about something over which we have no control. But one of the gifts of being human is that wonderful little evolutionary development called the neocortex. We are beings that are able to reflect upon our own existence. We are able to reflect upon our thoughts as we are thinking them. When we find ourselves reacting to something, whether negatively or positively, we have the ability to make the choice to pause, to step back and to examine our reaction and its context. We can then choose to either say, yeah, this is an appropriate response to the situation, or, wow, my response does not make sense. I wonder what in my history triggered this. Cast-offs. Okay, you can probably see where I'm going with this. I believe that our ability to think about our thinking is a kind of muscle that we can exercise and develop through spiritual practices such as prayer or meditation that allow us to calm the mind and center into the soul of our being. I've experienced this myself, and I'm sure many of you have too. It's when you get that insight, that aha moment, where you can see yourself with new eyes. It's that moment when you notice something that you must have been doing for years, and it was something that a parent did, and their parent did, and so on. There's a modern fable that nicely illustrates this story. A child stood and watched her mother prepare the annual holiday ham. The mother carefully cut each end off the ham before placing it in the pan. The child asked, "Mother, why do you always cut the ends off the ham?" The mother replied, "Well, that's the way my mother always did it." So the child called her grandmother and asked, "Grandma, how come you always cut off the ends of the ham?" The grandmother replied, "Well, that's the way my mother always did it." Finally, the child called her great-grandmother and asked, "Great-grandma, why do you always cut the ends off the ham?" The great-grandmother replied, "Because the ham is way too big to fit the small pan." Sometimes it's not until someone asks the question why that we even think to look at why we respond the way we do to any given situation. This happened to me recently. A friend of mine has a close relative who has been ailing over the past few years. Every time this relative has a health crisis, my friend travels hundreds of miles to be there. When this happened the first time or two, I assumed that the relative was at death's door. But after the fourth or fifth time, I asked my friend about it. I learned that in her family, whenever there was a crisis, everybody shows up for support. You see, in my family, we have a much different response. As long as one other family member is around, we figure things are under control. We usually don't all rally around until the very end when someone's actually dying. I wonder if this may be because of the experiences of war, where there were so many crises that a stoic response was developed as a family habit. Even though I didn't live through the trauma of war, I still inherited those responses. At first, I wanted to be judgmental of my friend about the differences in our responses. But as I developed a posture of curiosity, I learned something about myself and grew in the process. I decided that holding on to the stoicism that I had inherited wasn't reflecting who I really was and wanted to be, a compassionate, loving person who wants to be present when there's a crisis. Maybe not every time, but more often than I have been. Most humans have a vision of their best self. What that might look like might vary from person to person, but there seems to be a drive within us that calls us to be our better selves, and I think that's a core value of Unitarian Universalism. 19th century Unitarian minister and theologian William Ellery Channing called this tendency self-culture, and described it as reaching to connect to the spark of divinity within ourselves. So I invite you to look through your own inheritances. Which are heirlooms that are important to your own identity? What do you need to uncover and dust off so that you can engage with it with curiosity? And what might you cast off in order to make way for a new way of being in the world? May it be so, and amen. We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. Go in peace.